This evening, we're going to be looking at the third psalm in this series of lessons. Before we get started, though, I'd like to thank Mike for his prayer on my behalf. Hope you don't know something I don't. Looking at Psalms 3, there's certain fundamental issues, such as the importance of God's law in the life of a man, which we looked at in Psalms 1, and the ultimate victory of the Messiah, which we saw in Psalms 2. We're bringing these things together, you know, as we're looking at what our obligation is and what God can do for us in this. Then, putting those in the foreground, it is very proper to furnish man with a prayer book that would afford, you know, the beginning a morning prayer, which is what we're going to look at this evening, and then an evening prayer the next time we look at this, probably in 2 weeks, with Psalms 4. The heading carried by this psalm in the Hebrew text, and also in the Greek Septuagint, is it's called a Psalm of David when he fled before Absalom his son. So it gives us a historical reference for this. The context seems to agree with the history of David and the rebellion that was brought about by his firstborn in 2 Samuel 15, chapters 15 and 16. If one were to try and determine at what point during this rebellion that David may have composed this psalm, the probability is that it was on the second night after the rebellion was staged. 2 Samuel 17:22 leads to the conclusion that the first night was spent gathering, you know, the people together that were still loyal to David. This is, you know, found in 2 Samuel 17:22, and then that would leave like the second night, the only time that he, you know, could get to it and begin to compose it. 2 points before we get into the text itself. In the title is the first time we run into the term psalm, the Hebrew mezmor. And it appears its root idea is the meaning of the plucking of strings rather than to sing. It is best to consider it a psalm as a poem that is rendered with musical accompaniment, which is what we usually find David doing with a harp in his younger days. This is not necessarily a little side note authorizing musical instruments in the church. These were things that were more or less done on their own. In fact, we talked about the Psalms being really 5 books. You can see even the last book of the Psalms primarily is a collection of psalms that were sung. I think if you thought they would be more lend themselves to a worship service, but they were actually sung as people began to approach Jerusalem on the ascent. So none of it was really done during the worship assembly. Something else to be pointed out before we move on is the etymology of the word psalm. At this point in time, it does mean to pluck a string, but with an etymology or a change of language over 1,000 years, by the time the term is used in the New Testament, it means just to sing, which is why the translators translate it, sing. Okay? Another first is the use of that term selah that you're going to find at the end of some of the stanzas. Most agree that this is where a pause is desired for the singer or the reader to reflect upon the last statement made before the next thought appears. So it actually gives you a little breather time to meditate. You know, there's trying to tell you that's a very important point that was just made. You need to think about it. Musically, it may mark the spot where the music is to be played louder or the chorus is to be made, you know, or to make a repetition. Okay. With that said, beginning of the context here, it's going to set forth in two strophe, as we talked about last time, or stanzas at a time that they're grouped. The first two, O Lord, how my adversaries have increased. Many are rising up against me. Many are saying of my soul, there's no deliverance for him in God. And there's that little selah. This psalm is written to describe the situation of the author on the morning of a certain given day, just after he'd risen, The whole unhappy experience with its accompanying grief freshly impacts his soul immediately upon arising. So he wakes up and all of his troubles kind of weigh in on him. The chief cause of this distress is the enormous multiplication of his enemies. David's enemies are beginning to gather, all instigated by the machinations of his son. Note the repetition of the word many, three times in some translations. Since these are described as rising up against him, it is obvious that it is a rebellion that is being staged. The enemies, the many, are speaking words calculated to wound his very soul. The propaganda is that he has done some vile things, that he could expect no help from God, and has done things by which he has forfeited any right to appeal to God. Some of this you can start seeing the beginning of, if you want to turn to 2 Samuel in chapter 15, the beginning of it. I'll just read the first six verses where it says, "Now it came about after this that Absalom provided for himself a chariot and horses and 50 men as runners before him. And Absalom used to rise early and stand beside the way to the gate. And it happened that when any man had a suit to come to the king for judgment, Absalom would call to him and say, 'From what city are you?' And he would say, 'Your servant is from one of the tribes of Israel.' Then Absalom would say to him, 'See, your claims are good and right, but no man listens to you on the part of the king.' Moreover, Absalom would say, 'Oh, that one would appoint me judge in the land, then every man would have a suit or cause, could come to me, and I would give him justice.' And it happened that when a man came near to prostrate himself before him, he would put out his hand and take hold of him and kiss him. And in this manner, Absalom dealt with all of Israel who came to the king for judgment. So Absalom stole away the hearts of the men of Israel." He was out campaigning hard and trying to turn, through his propaganda, the people away from David. He eventually got together a strong enough army in order to oppose him. And then again, the accusations would increase from then. Harsher and harsher things would be said of David. But these accusations weren't groundless. For it is unquestionable that, according to 2 Samuel 12:10, the whole train of evil consequences that came upon David and his house were set in motion by his sin with Bathsheba and Uriah. Through his adultery, through his actually planning the murder of Uriah the Hittite. And here's the interesting thing in this psalm then, knowing this background, is that David's own sin is the primary cause of all his troubles. Then how can he have so cheerful an attitude and turn the matter over to God? He's always had God on his side, it seems like, and this is what they're trying to say on the opposition. He doesn't have that anymore. But the way the psalm is worded, it's like, hey, there's no problem. And this is something we want to kind of consider then. It gives us hope in our lives to be able to come to God. Let's see. Verses 3 and 4. "But thou, O Lord, art a shield about me, my glory, and the one who lifts my head. I was crying to the Lord with my voice, and he answered me from his holy hill." David's confidence is now apparent in this psalm, and it would be bold enough for him to have said that the Lord provides a shield for me, concerning the way the latter part of his life has been. It seems that God may have forsaken him, especially with the death of his firstborn. But it's even bolder for him to say, that God himself is his shield. It encompasses him all around. The next statement is almost incredible as he speaks of God being his glory. This does not merely mean that he is the one in whom I glory, but rather he is the source of my glory. David's fame and reputation were not slight, but he attributes it all solely to God. and nothing from himself. Thus, there's a parallelism that develops. That is, a rhyming of my glory and lifting my head. Okay, they're two terms that rhyme thoughts. This is the way Hebrew poetry goes. It doesn't rhyme words, it rhymes thoughts. And so it's roughly saying the same thing, but in a different way, so we can get the full impact of it. So he said that he lifts up my head. The meaning is that God is the source of any dignity that belongs really to anybody, but especially to David. Okay? In a broader sense, when God lifts up the head, he delivers a man from all those things that are pressing down on him or depress him. And David says, God is there for me. He's lifting my head. And again, David is doing this by inspiration. So it's not like he's making it up on his own. God is helping him write this. David also says that he cried again. This word, crying, the tense is such that it's an ongoing thing, especially if it's a present. It's something that that's done constantly in the past. The faithfulness of the Lord has always been there to bear him up. Okay. This help came from the holy hill. Keeping up with my own points here. Since Yahweh, the name of God, the personal name of God, was pleased to establish his dwelling place among the people in a central location, at this point Shiloh, they on their part would speak to him as being where he had said he would be, and he on his part would answer them from the same location. So it's his holy hill. This is where God was thought of residing, and this is where all of his holiness, his wisdom, his power comes from. And it is understood that this is an effective answering when God answers. That is, he starts things in motion that will bring about an answer to someone's petition. It's not just conversation. The next stanza is where David says, I lay down and slept. I awoke, for the Lord sustains me. I will not be afraid of 10,000 of people who have set themselves against me. The Hebrew tense here being the perfect, rightly construed, means all this continued action in the past that brings about the present situation and conveys something extraordinary. In fact, this is the high point of faith reached in this psalm. The emphatic I at the beginning points one in the right direction. The meaning is, we could reconstruct this in saying, in the great extremity in which David found himself, he was nevertheless enabled by God to rest safely and securely in the Almighty, so much that he had untroubled sleep in the midst of these gravest perils. Have you ever had something that just bothered you all night? And especially, it should have gotten to David to have all these people of his kingdom turn against him, especially his own sons. But he had such confidence in God, and God was with him to such an extent that he was able to sleep peacefully through the night. Thus then, he awoke in the morning, he awoke refreshed and able to meet the day's challenges. Verse 6 could almost be read in one breath with this. After having slumbered in the peace of God, the king upon waking recalls the multitude of foes. I mean, his pressures are still there, his problems are still there, but now he can meet it with courage. Okay, he is refreshed, and he knows God is with him, and so he can look to his enemies. The number is 10,000, and this is usually the translation for the word myriads. I ran across this in a child's book. On the Greek, the Greeks had a conception, and probably the Phoenicians before them and some of the Hebrews, is that the myriad was what it was described as the highest number attainable. And it happened to be 10,000. So every time the translators run across the word myriad, they just put in 10,000. But if you understand it as being the highest number they thought was possible, like our word infinity, then you can read this as also being innumerable. So there was probably more than 10,000. 10,000 is what they, as we're looking at on Wednesday nights, with, one of the tribes could raise 10,000 warriors. a third of the number of Ridgecast. Okay, he's looking at enemies that, you know, go way beyond that. I mean, from probably every tribe, there are those that have come together in order to try to overthrow David. In this, it is notable that the strophe does not end with a Selah. Okay, as you're looking at these various standards, two, this is the first combination of two where you won't find the Selah. Okay? This is not an oversight. Dietlich explains that the Selah is wanting because the clause, "I am not afraid," is not spoken in a tone of triumph. It's not David going out and going, "You know, I'm not afraid of anything." You know, it's like, but it's a very humble thing. His expression of his confidence in God. Therefore, it's just absent. It's not something that puffs him up. So you don't have to sit and pause about it. He wants you to view this as humbly, you know, just mention and move on. And then the final stanzas, or strophe, verse 7, "Arise, O Lord, save me, O my God, for thou hast smitten all my enemies on the cheek. Thou hast shattered the teeth of the wicked. Salvation belongs to the Lord. Thy blessing is upon thy people." The summons to arise is common in the Psalms and seems to be derived from the prayer of Moses found in Numbers 10:35. When the Ark of the Covenant was taken up to begin the children of Israel on their march to the land of promise, and so Moses would come out and to the people go, "Arise," and then get everybody started, especially since most of the time they had to face some enemies along the way. So David puts this in at this point. Since the current rebellion in view is against the established order of God and tainted with the spirit of heathenism, the summons is very appropriate. Further, the salvation requested is in the perfect tense, implying a history of help made available in the past. Thus, it is made by one who could venture to speak with such certainty. You know, David, as he's looked to God in the past, has always received it. I mean, this is how faith grows. This is how our faith grows. The more we rely on God, the more I realize that we can rely on God, the more our faith becomes certain. It begins to increase. The more we turn to God. And David, at this point in his life, knows it's a given. Such aid, notice the word hast, past tense, hast smitten my enemies, hath shattered the teeth. It's commonly regarded as the height of, first of all, the smiting of the cheek, the height of insult. I mean, this is common among any culture. I guarantee you, you go to anybody in any country and you slap them across the face, you know, they're not going to take it happily. Yeah. And David says, this is what God does to his enemies. Height of insult. Okay. And further, because of the enemy's hostility, they're likened to evil beasts whose overthrow is betrayed by the breaking of their teeth by God. Compared 1 Samuel 17:34. This is an incident early in David's life where he himself goes, okay, as a shepherd boy, you know, there's times when I had to go out and actually defend the sheep against bears and lions, whatever. And now the incident why he's relating this is to King Saul just before he's about to go out and face Goliath. And so he relates this, you know, the feeding of the beast, you know, with God's help, to, yeah, I can do it with our enemies also. You know, God will deal with them the same way. And so he has, you know, plenty to draw upon in this description. At the conclusion of the psalm, there is frequently found a substantial statement supplying a weighty termination. You know, just kind of leave you with something really dramatic, something really weighed down with, you know, God's wisdom. And so here we have, salvation belongs to the Lord. Okay. The actual word order puts the Yahweh first, as if to say, with Yahweh alone, are deposited all the resources of help, and how they shall be bestowed rests exclusively with Him. So it's all on God. He's the source of everything. You notice in all of this, no matter what he's talking about, David doesn't take anything to himself. He gives God the glory in all aspects of it. You might also see in this, equally significant is the second half of verse 8, in which the prayer of David is in behalf of his people. Even though they are sadly confused and harmed by the rebellion of his son Absalom, and some, you know, half of them are even against him, he still prays for them. I mean, he is the quintessential example of a good ruler. He still cares for his people, you know, even when they're not behaving themselves properly. Selfish concerns do not blot out the true and faithful king's sense of responsibility, though he later erred. You know, you'll find in 2 Samuel 19 where Joab has to admonish him, and he goes, "Yeah, the way you're behaving, you know, crying for Absalom and your enemies and stuff like that." He says, I think, you know, if your enemies had won and your own people had failed, you would have been just as happy as, you know, proud as punch. Yeah, so he had a wrong attitude then. But, you know, this is the thing about David and why these Psalms are important, is that, you know, David could mess up really big, but still he had a heart that God appreciated. I mean, when he messed up, he knew he messed up and took the appropriate steps in order to get back in God's graces. He shows that, you know, I doubt, you know, anybody would, you know, commit murder along, you know, with adultery. So if David could get forgiveness and get God back in his life to help him against, you know, a magnitude of a civil war in his own country, you know, we need to consider, you know, how we can approach God. That no matter how bad we've messed up, if we just do the things that God wants us to do, the repentance, the prayer of contrition, humbly approach him, you know, that humble approach can turn into confidence as we come to the throne of God. And we can still look to him, you know, to be back in our lives, even if we've walked away for a while. And this is important in the sense that only God's blessing can cancel the disastrous harm that may result to Israel from the threatening disorders of a nation. Okay? Some things only God can handle. And this is what we have to understand. Okay? We can't go it alone. I mean, it's great that we have that God's provided the church for us for support and encouragement and the strength, you know, to love and good deeds. But there's going to be things that either as an individual or as an assembly, we're not going to be able to handle by ourselves. And that's a given in this life. I mean, there's just too many problems, too many forces that are working against us that can easily overwhelm us. And it is God, one, that holds them at bay, and two, that begins to put blessings, you know, even in the most, you know, dreary of life, to make it bearable and to help us to overcome. And this is what David concludes with, you know, is this the blessing, God's blessing, upon the people. Quick summary. Look at the way David proceeds. My adversaries have increased. They're rising up against me. Many, you know, they've even started to say that there's no hope for me, even if I go to God, because my life is, you know, has been lived in such a way that it looks like, you know, I can't go to God anymore. But the Lord is my shield. That provides a shield, but he is my shield. You know, he's with David. He lifts up my head. You know, I used to cry to the Lord constantly, and he answered me, you know, from the power of his holy hill. Okay? So when I lay down now, I sleep, you know, peaceful dreams. And I wake up refreshed so I can take on anything because, one, my mind is clear, my body's ready, but I know God is behind me to help. I'm not afraid of an innumerable host of people, even though they encompass me roundabout. Therefore, arise, O Lord. Okay, we're about to proceed. You know, I call upon you as Moses did to save me, smite my enemies on the cheek as thou hast in the past, break their teeth as you've done, you know, many times before. Salvation belongs to you. Bless my people. because you're the only one that can. Okay. Now, this is why the Psalms are important, is that through David and Solomon and others, we learn to approach God in life. You know, we learn the things that we can approach Him with. We learn that, you know, in our troubles or in our blessings, there are all sorts of times in our lives, multifarious, you know, manifold, whatever, when we constantly have to turn to God, should turn to God. And the Psalms help us express ourselves properly in those circumstances. Through inspiration, David was allowed to approach God and puts it in words probably better than we could ever. So we can copy the same thoughts, the same concepts, the same words even. Don't get too repetitious. But it's a vehicle, it's an avenue to approach God in prayer and with a confidence that you can have God in your life and working with you in this life. And so this is, we're justifying this study, you know, as we're looking at it. And also, makes a good invitation, you know, whatever's wrong with your life, God can help. If take the right steps, first thing is to admit, you didn't even get this in psychology. Your first step is to realize you've got problems. You'll never get anything fixed if you don't think you've got a problem. And that's the problem with the world. Everybody thinks they're good people. According to Paul, though, we've all sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. And each one's got our own little particular problems and weaknesses. So realize what they are, face yourself truthfully, honestly, and begin the steps in order to get God in your life to strengthen you against your weaknesses, your own personal weaknesses, to help you with really the worldliness that's in all of us. I mean, how long was it before you decided you needed God in your life? You became a Christian. By that time, the world has had plenty of times to work on you. Okay? There is inside of all of us two souls. One that's starting to turn to God, and one that still has a little bit of an appetite for the world. And they're in conflict. And Paul represents that to us. We need to feed the one that's spiritual, the one that's godly, and we need to starve the one that's worldly. And we need God's help to do that. And we need each other's help to do that. If there's any way we can help you, please let us know as we stand to sing.